My name is Victor Kubik, President of the United Church of God. Welcome to another episode of Inside United. Throughout history, science has been seen as the antithesis to religion. So much so that in recent years, it has been taken up by many as a religion itself, with its own set of precepts and doctrines. However, science was never meant to be this. By definition, science is a tool for discovery and understanding our physical world. God's craftsmanship is what that tool uncovers. Almost 3 years ago, we released a two-part conversation with Dr. Stephen Britt about the impressive complexity of DNA and RNA, and how these small elements reveal big truths about life and creation. Today, we are re-releasing that conversation revised and re-edited into a single episode. Though the relationship between science and Christianity is often hostile, my guest, Stephen Britt, shows us that it doesn't have to be. God created a fascinating world, and there is much to learn about our Creator by better understanding His creation. My name is Victor Kubik, President of the United Church of God. We continue with Inside United with our guest, Dr. Steve Britt. Thank you for coming on the program today.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
We want to continue some of the discussions that we've had here about really the awesomeness of God, looking at creation itself. We've gone through talking about the universe, its vastness, but today we're going to take another step. Instead of looking up, we're going to look inside. We're going to look into the molecular world that is equally as fascinating, and discoveries are made there to me that rival those of astronomic. So that's what we'll be talking about today.
Yeah, it's exciting. We'll be able to look at things like DNA and genes and what makes us who we are at this biochemical level.
We're going to go and talk about some of these terms, and before we get fully into them, we really need to have a definition of them. So, Steve, tell us about DNA. What is DNA?
Well, Vic, it's deoxyribonucleic acid, obviously.
Oh, that's what I thought it was.
Well, yeah, so it is a molecular structure found in every living organism. You know, Watson and Crick, these scientists back in the 70s and 80s, discovered this material that carries the information that an organism passes on to its offspring. And they found this classic double helix structure. It looks like a twisted ladder at the molecular level. And each one of those rungs is a certain type of chemical bond. And the order of those chemical bonds are what determines the kind of proteins that an organism will make and ultimately makes us into who we are, or a frog into what it is, or an oak tree into what it is.
Well, at one time, even the astronomic world was looked upon as being quite simple with 5,000 stars or so, and that was it. And then it's found to be much, much bigger. In the same way, the genetic world was looked upon as DNA strands, as being just a coding, you know, of 23 things, and that was it. Now they're finding that there's sub, you know, layers of that, and they're finding it to be far more complex than what earlier was thought.
You know, they found that the human genome, so in our DNA, every one of us, we have something on the order of 6 billion actual base pairs, those rungs on the DNA ladder, and the way those are organized is really, really complex. So it's organized into what we call genes.
Well, before we get to genes, use the word genome, okay? And maybe explain genome and gene and how it relates to DNA so that we are all kind of knowledgeable of what we'll be talking about.
Yeah, sure. All right, so I already described the DNA ladder, right? And that whole long strand of DNA has about 6 billion of those base pairs, those ladder rungs. Gene is a set of rungs in the DNA ladder that make a single protein in your body. And that can be anywhere from, you know, a few dozen rungs to maybe tens or hundreds of thousands of DNA rungs or base pairs that end up going into one gene to make a protein. It depends on the protein being made.
And how many proteins are there?
So I believe they've identified around 20,000 genes in the human genome. So the genome is your entire collection of genetic information in your DNA.
Okay. Well, maybe I should introduce it now, but stem cells and so forth. And we might be jumping off topic, but these are things that people read in headlines before,
and
they become
right.
Controversies and so forth. So perhaps we could have, now that we have DNA understood, genome and gene, stem cells.
Yeah, well, stem cells are even more interesting. So we have our DNA that makes us who we are. And, you know, somewhere scientists haven't really identified where are also this set of instructions that tell a cell what kind of cell to be. You know, the DNA contains not only all the information about, you know, how long your hair is going to be and what color and your eyes and all that, but it tells cells in development in the womb as an embryo whether to become a skin cell or an eye cell, a photoreceptor in your eyeball, or, you know, a hair follicle or whatever it's going to be. Now, the cells, before they are differentiated, so that's the key word is differentiated, are stem cells. So meaning they haven't taken on that functional identity within the body yet. So people get very excited about stem cells in medical research because the idea is that if you have, you know, say stem cells of my own genetic material, then, well, if I need to grow a new kidney, I can grow one based off of my own DNA. I can just have a blob of stem cells and tell them in a certain way, differentiate, turn into a kidney, turn into kidney cells and all the various tissues that make up a kidney. And that's the idea behind stem cells that makes it so exciting.
I suppose the controversy is that somebody who could get in control of this and use it for nefarious purposes.
Well, yeah. Or things are just plain creepy, like the super meat that they're trying to grow and sell in stores. It's this, you know, meat grown in a lab, and that's kind of even as a consumer product, sounds very creepy. The things that you can do, the potential for people to do, you know, strange and terrible things to mankind is, again, like every other scientific discovery, expands that capacity.
Well, one thing that we wanted to talk about today was how DNA proves God's existence, so to speak.
Right.
I know that for some people who are, you know, atheists or agnostic, you can't prove anything to them because they already have it proved in their head, you know, mm-hmm. a conclusion. However, there have been people that were of this sort of mindset that said, wait a minute, this is awesome. This couldn't have just been randomly created.
Yeah, right. So mathematically, it's only in the last maybe 80, 90 years since about the 1930s when in mathematics we started talking about information theory and the transmission of information. And that's what DNA does. It transmits information from one organism to its descendants and preserving our genetic information that makes someone who they are. Well, a protein being encoded in DNA, what's stored in DNA is a representation of a protein, not the protein itself. You know, you might imagine one way a cell could work. This isn't how cells work, but you might imagine that a cell would have a copy of every protein it might ever need, and then one protein that can make copies of other proteins, and that's how the whole things work. It just goes to the master set, makes a copy, and then functions as needed. But that's not what happens. What actually happens is this DNA ladder, so I mentioned it has four different types of rungs. Mm-hmm. Any protein can be encoded, so that is represented by a sequence of these chemical bonds, these four letters, or nucleotides is the proper name for them. So there are four different nucleotides that any protein can be represented in DNA as. And that's something that within the realm of mathematics, within computer science especially, we've developed systems like that. That's how our computers work.
Right,
we have information storage is one of the foundations of the, you know, technological revolution. So those things were starting to be investigated back in the 30s by one of the primary mathematicians was Claude Shannon, and he developed his whole information theory, and he dealt especially with transmitting information across a channel. So for us, this is like an image, for example. Well, the way we store that digitally is by assigning colors to various pixels, and we turn the lights on, you know, at a very high resolution density so that it tricks your eye into thinking you're seeing an actual image. You know, when you look at a computer image of a building, you're not seeing a building, you're seeing a bunch of lights, right? Little point dots, and that's an approximation of the actual thing. And it allows our brains to see it and interpret it as a building. So that is itself a type of code, and the way that, you know, detailed information can be coded in a system that has nothing to do with the thing itself. You know, the pixels on a computer screen have nothing to do with the building. The chains in DNA have nothing to do with the actual protein. You know, the thing that makes it work is that you have an interpreting thing. So for us, it's our brains and our visual system that can interpret that digital image into knowing, oh, that's an image of a building. Whereas for DNA, you actually have these encoding systems in the what's called the RNA that can take the DNA code and turn it into an actual protein, take the representation of the thing and turn it into the actual thing. Mm-hmm. So I just find it fascinating, and I see that as clear evidence that there was an intelligent designer at play here, because it seems like in human history, as soon as we realize, oh, hey, look, you can encode things, you can represent things abstractly like this to transmit any message you could think of, you can put into binary language on computers, mm-hmm. ones and zeros. Well, God had already done that in DNA. Any protein you can think of, you can encode in these four letters, A, T, C, G, these nucleotides.
Could this have just kind of happened? I mean, this to me sounds like there's just a great intelligence, however people want to define it. You know, even people who are afraid to say God, you know,
yeah, right.
would have to say there's some kind of intelligent design in this, meaning that there's a designer.
One thing that makes it evident, and what's compelling for me, is the fact that we don't see this crop up anywhere else in nature. That, you know, either all of the abstract codes and representations like this are either a product of human design that's deliberate and thought out and we've had to kind of struggle to develop, or it's in the DNA. Those are the only two examples of this kind of abstraction that are really known to exist. Another point of how it doesn't seem like this could just come up randomly over time is a chicken and egg problem, right? If you have this, so how does an encoding system like this arise? How does it get started? Because it does no good to just encode a protein if you don't have a decoder, if you don't have some purpose for it. And it does no good to have the decoding apparatus if you don't have something encoded. So how did it get started? It's really unclear. At the DNA replication level, let alone the level of the survival of an organism as a whole, right? Because a lot more even goes into that, and it gets a lot more complicated and intricate than even just DNA replication. Another fact is that DNA is in fact a universal code, that the way that proteins are represented in the DNA of a human is the same as what you would find in a jellyfish. It's the same as what you'd find in a dandelion. If you have this segment of DNA with this set of instructions, it'll make the same protein no matter what organism it's in. And that, again, if you had an evolutionary process that resulted in this rather than it being designed and created, you would expect to see a lot of different encoding systems, right? You would expect that every organism would optimize its encoding system based on its particular needs. And, you know, there's no reason why a bacteria should be able to make this protein that's only actually found naturally in humans or in dogs or whatever. So I see all those as elements that point towards design, very clearly and deliberately designed systems.
And also, the fact that it could be stored in that way brings up the possibility or the reality of the fact that we could be stored. You know, everything that's about us could be put on our drive somewhere, you know, up there and wherever God is, and then retrieved. And we're getting closer now to the study of God using human beings and then giving us new bodies with the same identity mm-hmm. that we have and bringing all this back. It actually makes it more than just kind of a theoretical, wonderful, fuzzy thought, but something that's even scientific and something that has been coded as far as life itself in the DNA is something that God himself uses as a process to bring us back from the dust.
Yeah, even just the concept. I mean, this is a very modern concept in human thinking. And in fact, your article you wrote about that in the Beyond Today magazine hints of this, that people are reaching out and trying to do things like this. And it turns out God has a plan to do something very similar.
One thing that was mentioned in the book Immortal by Stanley Bing, at least when he was interviewed, was that they can do so many things in replication. They can do so many things in storage and mm-hmm. being able to digitize the brain and so forth. But he says, one thing we haven't figured out is life in the soul itself. He says, we still don't have that figured out what it is. It was interesting to hear somebody with a certain sense of humility, so to speak,
yeah, right.
of the fact that we don't have this one cracked, even though they may be trying to find out what the secret of that is.
Right, no one can quite pin down what that spark of life is.
Now, one of the subjects that we just barely gave a lick and a promise to is random mutation. We know that mutations happen, but why would God make a code that was susceptible to these mutations in the first place? Because they're there, and mm-hmm. if everything is supposed to be kind of functioning, you know, as it is, why would all of a sudden there be something different be introduced?
I'm going to take this back to the mathematical origins of information theory and the idea of communicating a message, over any medium you can think of, whether we're talking about language or whether you're talking about Morse code over a teletype or anything like that. There's always noise in the channel itself. So every once in a while, no matter how we're transmitting information, nothing comes across perfectly because we don't live in a perfect world. Now, what's really amazing about DNA is that even though it's copied these many, many times, I think in the course of, you know, a human DNA being transferred to our physical descendants, it's copied something like 20 or 30 times. I haven't fact checked that for myself, but when I was looking into it, that was about the number. And each time you're copying human DNA, you're copying the entire genome, which we mentioned, it's mm-hmm. about 6 billion base pairs, right? So every once in a while, one's going to end up wrong. Well, it turns out that across this entire DNA replication process, changing over these 6 billion base pairs that 20 or 30 times, you end up with only about one random mutation, only one rung out of 6 billion in the DNA ladder being copied all these many times that ends up changed at all. And compared to any information technology system that we have, that is ridiculously low. I mean, it's lower than we could ever hope to achieve in computers, but it is still there. It is still there. Now, it doesn't really have an effect, which is a big contrast, actually, to how scientists view things. The thinking that, oh, well, these random mutations, that's how we get the diversity of life, and that's how, you know, frogs developed into sheep eventually, mm-hmm. or, you know, whatever scenario they want to play out. But it turns out, actually, that these mutation levels are so low that it's hard to make a meaningful change to an organism that way.
Even the mutations that do come along, they're not destructive from the standpoint. I know that if I have a program that I'm loading on the computer,
yeah.
and you have corrupt code, the whole thing crashes.
Right, right. And that's a great example. You know, computer codes, there's a lot more things that can go wrong than can go right. If we look at any designed object, it tends to be that way, whether it's a computer program that you've written. If you've got a bug in the code and you have to search and search and search for it, one little piece was out of place and it caused the whole thing to be non-functional, mm-hmm. essentially. It can't run.
Irreducible complexity.
Yeah, we're getting towards irreducible complexity a bit. So similarly, so that's why I said a computer program can't run if something like that happens. Well, if you've got some defect in your DNA that describes how your leg's supposed to be built, you literally can't run, mm-hmm. right? An organism that can't run can't survive. And if it can't survive, it can't pass on its genetic material to the next generation. And from an evolutionary standpoint, that's all there is passing on the material to the next generation. So you're right. These random mutations tend to be destructive and harmful mm-hmm. rather than some great engine of evolution or something mm-hmm. like that.
Well, there's even some more marvelous things about just how that information is stored. Some of it is kind of forwards and backwards, and some of it is kind of coded in there with a hidden message and so forth. Can you maybe tell us about some of the, perhaps the humorous side of God? You
know? Yeah. Well, and it's incredible, really. This is even more modern findings just in the last couple of decades of genetics research where they've come to understand that DNA as a code is far more complicated than just reading off a set of instructions linearly linearly, right? Because that was the first thing that was understood about how DNA worked, is that the RNA would split the DNA strands in half and it would read it sequentially, one rung at a time until it got to the end of a gene, and that cut it off and made a protein and go to the next one and, you know, make all the things that it needs. Well, it turns out it's far more complicated. So not only there are a lot of different ways that's done, it's not just linearly, but there are sometimes ciphers used. So for example, if you watch a spy movie and or something like that, someone's trying to get a message out without anybody else being able to read it, they'll write a letter or something. And it reads just like a normal letter would read about, you know, the weather or something. But if you take the first letter of every line, for example, it spells out a hidden message like, you know, meet me at dawn or something like this. Well, it turns out in DNA, there are ciphers like that where you have a hidden message aside from just the linear message of DNA. So it can be understood in multiple levels, the same way that a spy code might be understood with a cipher like that. There are also cases where there's this phenomenon called backmasking, where sometimes a DNA strand, if it's read forwards, it gives you one message to create a certain type of protein, but it can also be read backwards. And this is done, in fact, by cells, not just that it can be, but is done. These sophisticated codes that are able to encode a very high density of information. If you think about something like this backmasking, how hard is it for us sometimes to even construct a sentence forwards, but let alone one that, you know, a human English language sentence that can be read backwards and have some information? It's almost like an art form to sit down and write something like that. Again, takes deliberate thought and planning and indicates a designer at work doing this, not just something that happened.
It's interesting. I toured a water treatment facility. One of my friends was the director of a whole shift in one of our major cities in the country of the water treatment system. And I spent a whole work shift with him on it. Well, the water comes in pretty filthy, you know, into a plant. We walked through the whole process and came out on the other end, we actually drank a glass of water, you know, from the water treatment plant. It was delicious, and so forth. But the point that he made here, and this is what I'm getting to, is that he said, the water that you are drinking right now has been reused and reused tens of millions of times. Mm-hmm. And these H2O molecules have not been corrupted. They're there. They are the same ones, you know, from back there. This is it. And it's just amazing the durability of those elements.
There was something I was reminded of when we were talking about how DNA is like an information transmission system. Like, for example, what allows a CD to play in your car, used to, that's a little antiquated, I guess, now, but what would allow a CD to play in your car without skipping are these error-correcting codes where, say, I don't just send the message, I send a little bit of extra information along with it so that if something goes wrong, it can be automatically corrected and understood by the person on the other side. So one way to do this, just a simple example, is if I wanted to send you the message banana. All right, so one thing I could do is I could say banana, 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 banana. And you would know on your end that, well, he's going to send whatever the message is four times. So if you hear banana, 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 bonono, you know that the bonono was wrong and you go with the majority thing. Well, we see that kind of error correcting mechanism. And that's a very inefficient example. That's not actually what DNA does. And it's not actually what computer scientists do. But that's the basic idea, that you can have a self-correcting transmission system. And DNA has that built in. And DNA and the code involved and just the intricacy of how it all works is an elegant system. Something like that is not seen ever just arising anywhere else, you know, except in DNA. And I very clearly think that's evidence of a creator who made it fearfully and wonderfully.
All the physical stuff, so to speak, is only just one indicator of something even broader, because God is love and God is one who does it for a purpose of caring. And in a sense, all this replication is a replication of himself.
Yeah, and I think to that point, we see all of this design, and that's all part of how we function and how we are who we are and how we're able to do these things. But if you think about God creating these things with a purpose and what that purpose is, you know, the Bible tells us that God's purpose is to bring many sons to glory. And so he created us in a way that we could understand things like right and wrong. And we have the physical ability to do right and wrong, and to understand the difference, to come to know him. And, you know, he gave us, it's like God at every step gives us enough capacity to draw a little closer to him. That's our whole discussion about the spirit of man. That's what that's about. That's what our intelligence is about and our capacity to reason is about. It's about us being imbued with enough understanding and reason ability to start to understand God a little bit more, a little bit more. And then we get the spirit of God in us, and that opens up spiritual understanding that we didn't have before. And we get to know God a little more and a little more. And the whole thing really is a development process of God bringing us to be more and more like him, both in practice as well as capacity. This isn't a matter of being some super smart intellectual person or, you know, someone who's not as smart. It's a matter of God's individual revelation to us of who he is and the reality that he is out there.
And when you have that as a base, then science not only has its place, but it has its context, where you're not denying evidence, you are supporting evidence. You find things that support it.
Right.
And it doesn't take away from the knowledge, it doesn't take away from the facts, the senses, and so
right.
forth from it. It enhances them.
And, you know, there's an important distinction there. Knowledge only goes so far until someone gets hungry for meaning, because meaning goes beyond knowledge. And that's what we ultimately have through an understanding of God and his role as the creator. Because without a creator, everything devolves into meaninglessness.
Mm-hmm. And that meaning, I guess you might say, is either a synonym or just a stepping stone to purpose.
Right. Very good.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Stephen Britt. These topics are as fascinating as they are complex, and I appreciate Stephen for joining us and sharing his insights. Thank you for joining us today on Inside United. You can write to us at podcast@ucg.org. That's podcast@ucg.org. Tell your friends about Inside United. You can find us easily on the ucg.org website. Go to the main menu line by clicking or tapping on the podcast button. You can also find us on Spotify. Go to podcasts and search for Inside United. Also, you can use your favorite Apple or Android podcasting app and have the podcast come to you. So have a great week. Come back soon for more.
This is a production of the United Church of God. For more, visit ucg.org.